You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, a nonpartisan review of the 2020 election found no widespread fraud in Wisconsin, but did issue a set of recommendations to improve elections administration in the state. We'll talk to one of the Republican lawmakers who ordered the audit about the results and what comes next. Now, a new exhibit at the Washburn Area Historical Society Museum celebrates a man known as the godfather of modern surfing, who just happens to be from Wisconsin. Tom Blake was born in Milwaukee in 1902 and grew up in Washburn. He would go on to totally revolutionize the world of surfing. The design of modern surfboards is thanks largely to Tom Blake. So is the style of contemporary surfing photography, those photos that make you feel like you're riding the wave with the surfer. And that chill, hang-loose attitude, that was born and bred Wisconsinite Tom Blake as well. We have another Tom Blake with us, the nephew of surfing legend Tom Blake. Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
What do you remember most about your uncle?
Well, for me personally, I really didn't get to know him till he was in his later years, and I mostly remember him just being a real humble, very quiet. A lot of what I know about him, I learned after he passed away, and so he didn't talk much about his accomplishments, but he was very quiet, very kind person. Didn't have a lot to say about it. So like I said, I learned a lot of what I know about him after he passed away.
Yeah, how did you realize what a legend your humble uncle was down the road?
Well, my wife and I had made a trip to Hawaii, and I was staying in a hotel and went down to the gift card shop, and there were postcards with his picture on it and talking about it. And so we visited a lot of the surf shops there and found all kinds of stuff. And then I started collecting, anything I could get my hands on about him. And that's where I really, learned the most that I did doing it that way.
And there's a pandemic echo here. I understand he got into surfing after he dropped out of high school during the 1918 flu pandemic. Can you talk about what led this kid from Wisconsin into the world of surfing?
Yeah, he had mentioned that he saw a newsreel clip when he was 9 or 10 years old in Washburn, and it showed Hawaiian surfers at Waikiki, and that really struck with him. And then when he left Washburn during the pandemic, he went to stay with some relatives in Detroit, and he met Duke Kanemoroko, and his teammates were coming back from the Antwerp Olympics. In a movie theater, they were showing highlights of their performance there. And he went up and introduced himself and said that Duke was, very accommodating. And Tom kind of took that as an invitation to come see him. So 4 years later, he took a steamship to Hawaii. And Duke wasn't on the island at the time, but Tom got connected with his brothers, and Sam Kanemoroko in particular, and surfed with them and swam with them. And he only stayed for about a year, and he went back to California, where he had moved shortly after meeting Duke in 1920. And he started competitively swimming there, and made another trip a couple of years later to Hawaii. And then he went back there pretty much every year for the next 30 years, other than the war years. But he, while he was in Hawaii, he spent a lot of time at Bishop Museum studying the old ancient Hawaiian boards, and started to experiment with those boards were huge and very, very heavy, and he started experimenting with first drilling holes in them to make them lighter, and then making kind of hollow chambers, and he ended up creating much lighter, faster boards and set all kinds of surfing race records in Hawaii. And that's kind of how he got over there to begin with.
And surfing had been around, of course, for thousands of years on Pacific
Correct.
Islands. Did the changes Tom made to the board and things like that help it catch on elsewhere in the world?
Absolutely. The lighter weight boards, I think the older boards were, 100, 150 pounds. And ultimately, he got the board down to, I think, about 50 pounds or less. So it certainly introduced it, made it feasible for women and children to take up surfing, and it made it much easier to manufacture, eventually when the veneer finishes and it made for, mass production of the board. So it definitely did promote surfing from where it had been.
and also surfing photography. Your uncle made it, Tom Blake, made a big difference there. What was his innovation?
Well, he invented a waterproof camera housing, and then he started taking pictures from the surfboard. And he was first published in National Geographic in 1935 as an article titled Waves and Thrills on Waikiki that had a bunch of his pictures, and it showed people in Waikiki doing tandem surfing and just kind of, glorified the sport of surfing and brought a lot of attention to it. And his photography got a lot of publications in some, major publications on the mainland that kind of spurred the interest in surfing over here.
We often think of surfing, modern surfing, as having kind of that chill, hang loose attitude. Was that an innovation of your uncle as well?
Well, I don't know about an innovation, but he definitely reflected, I think, that lifestyle that you think of. He was very extremely handsome, I guess, and tanned, and had the surfer's physique, and he also had the kind of carefree attitude, surf all day, and he kind of worked different jobs. He would lifeguard. He would he actually, when he was in California surfing, he did acting jobs. He was in several movies when he was out there, but he would just make enough money to surf for another month or two, and then he'd get another job. And he lived pretty much out of his van, didn't have a lot of material things, so I think he kind of embodied that hang loose culture.
I gotta ask, Tom, did Wisconsin surfing legend ever take his nephew Tom to try to introduce him to surfing?
Well, he took me and my brothers out on Chemaumegan Bay on Lake Superior a couple of different times when we were younger, and we never did have that skill that he had. We enjoyed going out there and visiting with him mostly because we didn't get to see him a lot, but none of us were watermen, that's for sure.
Tom, thanks a lot for joining us.
I appreciate you having me. Thanks. Thank you.
Tom Blake, he talked to us about his uncle, the Wisconsin surfing legend, Tom Blake. The Washburn Historical Society Museum has an exhibit about the surfer, Tom Blake. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about family names.
In most cities and towns, there are last names that stick out. Maybe the family has lived there for generations, perhaps they're notorious, or maybe they own a well-known business. For writer Sandy Reitman of Milwaukee, her semi-famous last name sticks out mostly thanks to her beloved uncle.
As a kid, I woke up to the sound of my uncle's voice on my little white FM radio alarm clock every morning before school, along with half the city of Milwaukee.
94 WKTI Milwaukee. Reitman and Miller at 5 o'clock. Let me start off your Monday morning.
My Uncle Bob was the Reitman half of Reitman and Miller in the morning on 94.5 WKTI Milwaukee, playing the music of the 80s, 90s, and today for many years. He was a big voice with a unique last name in a small city. But the last name didn't start its recognition there. My grandfather, Robert Reitman Sr., was an FBI agent and served as commissioner of the Whitefish Bay Police and Fire Department, so his name was known about town. His namesake son, Bob, the radio host, was the total anti-culture of his father, becoming somewhat of a civil rights movement activist and the city's original hipster. His career started on public radio, then on to underground radio, to morning radio, and now full circle back to public radio. His listeners have loyally followed him along the way, also remembering the Reitman last name. The first time I remember learning that it was unusual to have your uncle on the radio was when my elementary school music teacher repeated a fact that she had learned about me on the radio that morning. Maybe it was my birthday or something, I can't really remember, but I was beyond confused and embarrassed that this teacher and now my entire class could learn things about me on the radio. After school, I talked to my parents about how it all works, and I soon became much more interested in the fame that came with my name than whatever was bothering me earlier. My big brother, Kevin, was an active Boy Scout around that time and took his whole troop with him to the WKTI radio studio for some kind of patch earnings activity. I, of course, tagged along with all the boys. I remember being in the sound production room while the troop was in the studio, amazed to see how radio works behind the scenes. This was my first backstage moment of my life. My parents were used to the "Are you related to Bob Reitman?" question as they grew up hearing it. My dad had the little brother complex, but also made his own name for himself. As I got older, my friend's parents started to ask me more about my uncle and what's he really like, and I would engage their questions. But around town, he was just a likable guy. When I was old enough to make purchases with a debit card, cashiers would ask me, "Are you related to Bob Reitman?" And I would oblige this question from strangers because I was proud to be his niece. I ran off to New York City for 10 years, only to get a couple "Are you related to Ivan or Jason Reitman?" questions. A famous Hollywood directorial family of which I am not related to, but occasionally would lie and say I was just to get the reaction. When I moved back to Milwaukee in my early 30s, I noticed that the Reitman question came up less and less. I started to miss being asked it, actually. Recently, this whole saga came full circle when someone asked my dad, "Are you Bob Reitman's son?" That was all the validation my dad needed after years of being the disc jockey's little brother. I recently reconnected with my elementary school art teacher, also a Milwaukee native who listened to my uncle her whole life. She told me a story where she was talking about Reitman on the radio, and whomever she was speaking to said, "Oh, like Sandy Reitman?" Full stop, full circle, I had officially moved from BTS to VIP status. So, what's in a semi-known German-Jewish last name in a big, small city like Milwaukee? For me, it's a sense of pride and an even bigger sense of comfort. We Reitmans are at home when in Milwaukee.
Sandy Reitman is a writer who lives in Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, Republican State Representative Samantha Kirkman joins the show to break down the results of a recently released nonpartisan review of the 2020 election in Wisconsin. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A nonpartisan review of the 2020 election in Wisconsin was released last week, and it found no evidence of widespread voter fraud. But the Legislative Audit Bureau did release a list of dozens of changes it says could improve the way elections are run in the state. Our next guest was one of the lawmakers who ordered the audit earlier this year. Samantha Kirkman is a Republican who represents Wisconsin's 61st Assembly District, which includes Western Kenosha County. She's also co-chair of the Joint Legislative Audit Committee. Representative Kirkman, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob, for having me on. I really appreciate it.
What's your main takeaway from this extensive report?
Well, I appreciate the work of the Audit Bureau. It's 110 pages that they have given to us. And so there is a lot of detail and a lot of things that, you know, we're working through right now to try to analyze and figure out. There were 30 findings and 18 recommendations for legislation. Some of those things, revolve around training, revolve around how the ballots are handled through the absentee process, just many different things that have given us a blueprint for going forward.
State Senator Rob Coles, your co-chair on the Joint Audit Committee, tweeted last week that the report shows the election was, quote, largely safe and secure, end quote. Do you agree with that? A brief summary of his tweet?
Well, you know, again, many different things were found by this audit. So, again, things for legislative consideration, things that the legislature has already been considering. When we gave them the scope of the audit, there were four main areas that we wanted them to look at. It was the statewide voter registration list, which is called WisVote. It found that there are many challenges with that. In particular, you know, how they're maintained and who maintains them. The absentee ballots, questioning, you know, the special deputies, you know, when absentee ballots are given out to nursing homes, questioned, you know, the guidance that was given by WEC, literally went against state statute. So I do think those are serious things that we need to rectify going forward in elections.
In a statement this afternoon, state Senate leaders said the Audit Bureau's report shows, quote, numerous failures within the Wisconsin Election Commission, which undermined the free, fair, and transparent elections Wisconsinites deserve. So some of your Republican colleagues on the Senate side kicking off a new investigation now. Undermined. Do you think that's a strong word, or do you think there's that it's fair to say that?
Well, I think we need to go forward. Our elections are the foundation of our government. You know, if people don't have faith in our elections, that creates a problem going forward. So we want our constituents, Democrat and Republican, independent, other Green Party people, to have faith in the process. And this is what, you know, their expectation is of legislators are, is to make sure that's happening.
Talking to Representative Samantha Kirkman from the State Assembly, co-chair of the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, looking at a Legislative Audit Bureau report on the 2020 election in Wisconsin. Representative Kirkman, a lot of the recommendations seem to be looking for clear guidance for local election officials, whether it's whether you can use lockboxes, or if you can use lockboxes, how to secure them, where they can be, how to handle absentee ballots that don't have complete witness addresses. A lot of clarification things. What stands out to you about things where we just need more clear and consistent rules like that?
Well, you gave two perfect examples that I think the audit gave that blueprint for, in saying, you know, state statute says that you can't, you know, do certain things. And again, WEC gave guidance that was contrary to that. So going forward, we really need to make sure that our statutes are clear. And so this is where we need to sit down and work through these. And it's nonpartisan. You know, that's where I hope that we can find common ground together to put legislation on the governor's desk, and he will be supportive of it.
Let's bring on a caller. Mo is with us in Oconto. Mo, hello.
Yes, I'd like to know why this. It almost seems like a farce how it's a right to vote. It's a duty to vote. And we're actually trying to make it harder to vote. How does that benefit the Wisconsin people when it is a felony when you cast a vote and you're not the legal voter? And how does this benefit the taxpayer?
Well, our foundation of our elections are so critical. You know, it's the one thing that people want to have faith in. You know, there have been elections that have been decided in my area of the state by one vote. And so going forward, every vote and making sure that vote is accounted for and is legal is really important. You know, making sure our WIS vote or our statewide voter registration list is clean and merged or purged. I'm, for instance, on that list twice. So my maiden name is on there and my married name. But the voter contact or the contact is from 1996. That voter list wasn't created until 2005. So how was it even put on the list? So these are those questions that, again, making sure our lists are, you know, our clerks have clear guidance that follows the state statute, because they're the ones, we have the most decentralized election system amongst our states, because we have 1,800 different municipalities that are running elections. And again, making sure that they have the correct information and the right information that follows state statute.
Thanks for the call, Mo. We'll go to Scott in Menominee. Scott, hi.
Hi. I guess with Ms. Kirkman there on the air and stuff, you know, we've got a lot of legislators in particular in this election review and whatnot that have been in office down there for quite a while, but I want to know, why wasn't this an issue in the last couple election cycles while they're in the office? And I guess I don't want to go much further than that. But
Scott, I gotcha. So the elections commission we have now created came into effect, I think, in 2016. Why this review now? Why not sooner? I guess he's asking.
So I'll give you an example. So actually, there was a previous audit of the election back in 2014, which several of those recommendations, and actually we had a change state statute, and the former GAB then became what's known as the Wisconsin Elections Commission. So based on the previous audit in 2014 and those recommendations, we created this, you know, what was known as the Government Accountability Board, and determined that the Government Accountability Board wasn't necessarily run efficiently and effectively. So then was created the Wisconsin Elections Commission. So correct, the previous audit in 2014 created what was called WEC now, and so it was a good overview to see if they were actually following the state statutes that are currently on the books.
Thanks for that call. Representative Kirkman, with a lot of issues, Republicans in the legislature want to do one thing. The Democratic governor, Governor Evers, doesn't like it. We end up with a standoff. Do you see room for taking this audit, working together across party lines, and making some of the changes you're hoping for?
Well, I hope so. You know, we have several different, you have the elections committee. We have now our audit committee can take a look at all these findings and put legislation forward. So I hope that we can find common ground and get that across to the governor's desk.
And is there a particular change, again, 100 plus pages, is there a particular change you're really hopeful for?
Well, there's several. I mean, you know, there's 18 legislative findings that we could go forth with different legislation. Different pieces of legislation. So I think there's many different pieces that will, you know, strengthen the system that we have, making it harder to cheat, easier to vote, and go forward from there.
Representative Kirkman, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Republican State Representative Samantha Kirkman, who co-chairs the Joint Legislative Audit Committee. She was with us today to talk about the findings out last week from a nonpartisan audit of the 2020 election in Wisconsin. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, many communities in the U.S. have seen a jump in shootings in the last 2 years. The creators of The Violence Project are out with a new book. They join the show for a look at the causes and some promising solutions to the problem. And it's a battle for the ages. Which pastry says Wisconsin to you? Is it the cream puff or the Kringle? We'll invite you to join the debate and share your favorite. A lot of people getting started on this on Twitter already, and we have it up on the Ideas Network Facebook page, so you can weigh in now. If you had to pick just one dessert to stand the test of time, is it the cream puff or is it the Kringle? If so, what flavor? Tweet us at Central Time WPR or head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. If you want to make the case for a whole another candidate, a third party, let us know. All that and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, are you planning to buy any trendy gifts this holiday season? You might want to start now to make sure you not only get them, but get them on time. We'll find out why the global supply chain is broken and how it could be fixed. First, we count on satellites in various orbits for communication, GPS, weather forecasting, scientific research, and a lot more. And military and intelligence services around the world have a lot at stake in Earth's orbit, too. Satellites are really vulnerable, and the international agreements that manage conflict in space are old and very, very limited. That has some experts worried that a small provocation in orbit could lead to a much bigger conflict. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you rely on satellites for your work, for example? Do you have questions about how Earth's orbit is being divided up, filled up in many cases, and how a possible conflict could play out in space? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Rachel Reeder wrote about orbital conflict in the new cover story at Harper's Magazine, Ad Astra, The Coming Battle Over Space. Rachel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Before we get to the potential for conflict in orbit, can you set the stakes for us a little bit? I gave a quick list there of how we count on satellites. How much, especially in the United States, do we rely on the existence of lots and lots of satellites?
Sure. It's a really, they really underpin so many different parts of daily life, you know, weather, navigation, communications, broadcasting. They're a huge piece of infrastructure for civilian life. And they really also are hugely important for the military that relies on them for, you know, everything from communications to nuclear command and control. They're really, I think most of us take them for granted and don't think much about them, but we are all using them all the time.
For conflict on land and sea and in the air, there's a lot of international law and military protocols and things like that. You write that there's really not much of that in place for space, and what there is really old and out of date. What kind of international anything governs space conflict?
Right. The main piece of international law that governs conflict in space is the Outer Space Treaty, which is from 1967. So it was written when there were only a few satellites in orbit. No one had been to the moon. It's just really written from a different time. And it has a lot of provisions that lay the groundwork for how militaries are able to operate in space. It prohibits the use of weapons of mass destruction. It prohibits the establishment of a military base on the moon or other celestial bodies. But it doesn't speak to a lot of the more contemporary technologies, or like the issue of crowding was simply not on anyone's mind in 1967.
How crowded is it getting up there?
Very crowded. I mean, it's interesting because space is obviously enormous. There's plenty of space in space. But the most useful parts of space are a couple of orbital belts, low Earth orbit and geostationary orbit that's further away. And so the most useful sort of tracks around the planet are getting crowded. They're getting so crowded that there's an office in the U.S. military that tracks all the satellites that are orbiting the Earth and keeps track of their trajectories and issues warnings to the satellite operators when it sees that two satellites are on a course to come very close to each other. And that agency is now issuing thousands of those warnings every day. Even though actual collisions are extremely, extremely rare, there are more close calls now.
When we think of militarized satellites and threats to satellites, it may sound like science fiction. And yeah, maybe someday in the future, this is a problem. As you write, no. This is happening now. What kind of things are going on over our heads here?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it does sound a lot like science fiction. But there are satellites that are used by the military to, for reconnaissance. Those are sort of well established. There have been several tests of anti-satellite weapons that cause a lot of debris. And so China has successfully tested an anti-satellite weapon. The U.S. has also. Those are very rare. There's a sort of deterrence built in because when something is hit in space, it creates this cloud of debris that then makes it difficult for satellite operators to maneuver. It creates this cloud of very high speed junk. So there are those deterrents that are built in, but those weapons that can target satellites physically have been tested. And what people are really concerned about now is a sort of new generation of sort of subtler weapons that aren't, it's not a physical weapon like a projectile being aimed at a satellite, but things like a laser that could be aimed at a satellite and disable its optics, or the use of microwaves or chemical sprays that could disable different features of satellites. And those are sort of they're less dramatic than an explosion, but can be just as disabling.
Talking to Rachel Rederer about her new piece, the cover story at Harper's Magazine, Ad Astra, The Coming Battle Over Space. You can call in with your questions and thoughts at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Jeremy is with us in Appleton. Jeremy, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Jeremy?
Well, she kind of set it up for me. One of the concerns that I've heard is this probability of a cascade event. So the crowding and this issue of a cloud of high-speed debris created by a damaged satellite or a collision could then hit other satellites, and then they would break apart and create even more debris. And this would basically cascade into an event that would destroy a large portion of the satellites in particular altitudes or particular belts, and essentially make space travel very difficult, because there'd almost be like a layer of garbage you'd have to pass through that would be very dangerous. What's her thoughts on that, or the probability of this cascade event occurring?
Interesting. Rachel, you just touched on that. Can you expand on that a little?
Yeah, that's such a good question. The people who really focus on this are absolutely concerned about that possibility. That that cascade event is known as the Kessler syndrome, and it's something that people have been thinking about for decades. And, you know, it's hard to put a numerical probability to it. It is something that people, it is a real concern. It's not something that is imminent, but it certainly, the way that debris could potentially snowball means that, you know, a few big collisions could trigger that cascade effect pretty quickly. The good news is that everybody who is operating in space has a very strong incentive to not let that happen. And so satellite operators, you know, are careful about avoiding collisions. And there are some startups in the works right now who are working on technologies that could clean up space debris, that could, you know, satellites that could go out into those busy orbital belts that are equipped with ways to grab some of the debris and take it out of orbit. But that said, of course, you know, it's much easier and preferable to stop something like that before it happens than try to clean it up afterwards, especially with something like that, where the cascade effect would be so strong.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Rachel Reeder about the new race for military presence in Earth's orbit, lack of international agreement about how that should all work. You can read that as the cover story in Harper's Magazine, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Who should make the calls when it comes to what is up in Earth's orbit and what kind of military presence, what kind of military activity should and shouldn't be allowed up there? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Harper's Magazine contributor Rachel Reederer, looking at the growing international presence in Earth's orbit and the military questions that come along with that. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us in Port Wing. Chris, hi.
Hi. Thanks for the show. You know, I'm very concerned since the United States started its Space Force a few years ago that this is a clear militarization of space, and it causes some severe diplomatic problems for keeping space unmilitarized. And then I'm also interested in your guest commenting on who gets to choose who throws satellites up there. For instance, Elon Musk is in the process of throwing 1,200 satellites up there for communications, and he's already done more than 300. We can see these at night. They're just obnoxious. And he didn't ask me. He didn't ask you. Nobody asked anybody, it seems like. Who's in charge of who gets to pollute space?
Chris, two big questions. Thanks for that, Rachel. Let's start with the first one, Space Force and what it meant for the international diplomatic scene when it comes to orbit.
Yeah, it's such a good question. And I do think that one of the things that I really realized while reporting this piece is that we talk about the militarization of space as if it's happening right now and as if it's brand new, when really militaries have been using space as a resource for a long time, and it doesn't get discussed very much. So it's not that the creation of Space Force is itself a huge change in the way that the U.S. military is actually using space to support its existing missions. But it is certainly from a public relations angle, it certainly came with a lot of hype, came with a lot of talking about U.S. maintaining its absolute supremacy in the realm of space. And I do think that that creates some difficulties in international diplomacy, and it makes it harder to make the case that other nations should not engage in space war and space weaponry when the U.S. is doing so quite publicly itself. So it absolutely complicates that conversation.
And Chris also asked about who's the register of deeds for territory in orbit. If I want to put up a bunch of satellites, do I have to ask somebody where they can go?
Yes, so that is a really great question. You do have to register your satellite. The United Nations maintains a database of all the satellites that are orbiting the Earth, but you don't have to ask for permission to put the satellite into a certain orbital path. And that is actually something that as these useful orbital pathways become more and more congested, people are starting to talk about the possibility of establishing some sort of really traffic management system. I mean, if you think about, the way that we drive, we have lanes, we have traffic signals, we have ways for drivers to understand each other's behavior. And that's, obviously we know that that's so important in space. Once a satellite is registered, there aren't lanes in the orbital pathways. There aren't rules of the road about where they can go or how close they can get to one another.
Thanks a lot for the call, Chris. We're talking to Rachel Reeder about her piece on orbital conflict in Harper's Magazine. Before we go back to our callers, Rachel, I want to ask you about a nightmare scenario. I'm a country. I have a lot of satellites up there. All of a sudden, they start to go dark. And I have to ask, is this an accident? Is this a test cyber attack or physical attack? Or is it a real attack and it's a nuclear war is about to start or some sort of territorial invasion and they're trying to blind my military? And I've got about 2 seconds to decide. How big a concern is this?
I mean, it's a huge concern. And one of the things that a satellite expert told me that really stands in my mind is that when it stands out is when it comes to space, you can see who, you can see what, you can see where, satellites, you can see them from space. I mean, you can see them in space from Earth, but you can't see why. You don't know why a satellite is doing a certain behavior unless you talk directly to whoever is operating that satellite. And so if there is some aggressive behavior, if two satellites were to collide, and there is a question as to why that happened. Did one satellite lose control and it was a true accident, or was it an attack? Those questions are paramount. And that is really why the diplomacy element is, I really think its importance cannot be overstated, that there's a real limit to how much we can understand and inform correct decisions just by observing satellites. We really have to be able to speak to one another and have honest conversations about intentions of what is happening that we cannot see from Earth.
Let's go back to our callers now. David is with us in Ashland. David, hi.
Yes, I think the whole thing of Space Force in the wrong direction. We need cooperation. I also heard that some of the weather satellites were getting pretty old and needed replacing. Do you happen to know if they funded money for the replacements of these satellites, which are crucial with this global warming world?
David, thanks for the call. First, that second part first, briefly, Rachel, do you know about the, outdated weather satellites?
I don't know about that, actually. Yeah, it's a great question. They're certainly important. I'm not sure what sort of plans for replacement there might be.
And to David's main point, cooperation sounds good in principle. What have been the obstacles to the kind of cooperation David was referencing and you were starting to touch on there too, Rachel?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the main obstacles is simply that the major space powers, the US, China, Russia, and then several others as well, but those are certainly the big three. No one is in a hurry to limit their own options. And so there has not really been an appetite for a new set of international agreements that might shift the focus cooperation and arms control.
We're losing you there, Rachel. I think we'll wrap it up at this point. Thanks a lot to Rachel Reeder from joining us from Harper's Magazine. You can read her new piece there, the cover story, Ad Astra, The Coming Battle Over Space. Do we have her back? Let's see. Rachel? Oh, just in our...
Hi.
Okay, there we go. You were breaking up there on us. I want to just take a minute to look at... You write about the prospects for some cooperation, maybe not a formal treaty, but people from many of these countries were talking about getting together in a less formal way. Do you see hope there?
I do. Two projects that are so interesting are these... what are called manuals that are being developed. One is the Woomera manual and one is the Milimos manual. And both of those are projects being written by groups of international military experts and scholars who are coming together to create documents that really take a very close look at the space law and space practice that does exist. And what they're trying to do is take those sparse documents and really read them so closely, map those principles onto the behavior and incidents that we've seen in the past couple of decades of crowded space, and create a document that really lays out best practices for, here is the distance that a satellite can come to another satellite before being seen as a threat, or really spelling it out in a way that hasn't been done before. And those two projects have been in the works for years. They're pretty close to completion. And so, yeah, I do have high hopes for those documents creating a way for militaries to have better conversations and to just generally provide clarity that has been lacking.
Rachel, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
That's Rachel Reeder, a writer and Harper's Magazine contributor. We talked to her about her latest piece for the November issue, which looks at the lack of rules and organization around who gets to do what in space and what that could mean for international conflict. Coming up after the news, we'll take a look at what's fueling the supply chain disruptions around the world and what it could take to fix them. And that may be a long time coming, it turns out. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.